Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-hosts.
Rob Shard.
Recap 2468.
Alright, so alongside the ice cream cone machine running in the background, he has one other suggestion.
This is episode 183. I'm here with Dan Q.
Let's find a replacement.
Makalua.
Oh, now I have to drink double the coffee.
The Mian Team.
Welcome, subjects, to the Kingdom of Conage.
Guest co-host, Recap 2468. Audio problems for the win.
Yeah. It mostly doesn't do it when he talks.
Mostly. Some occasional exceptions to the rule. But rules were made to be broken after all, especially if you're an AI.
And Scott.
Yeah.
That works. Nice intro, Scott. Well done. Updating espionage system to Brave New World game mechanics started by Alkibiad. I can't get away from these usernames that I just butcher the pronunciations for. I need forum names like Zach or something, or just like Bugbear. You know, stuff that's easy to read for me. I apologize if I butchered your name. Threadraise, I've been previously advocating for major overhauls on the espionage system, and E-Link's another thread. And along behind those changes, I do feel that some minor tweaks could be done to bring this system in line with how other game features work in Brave New World. Okay, so a couple of his suggestions. First of all would be to change spies to work like caravans and that you have a maximum cap determined by your era, possibly other factors as well, but you still have to produce them. Feels it would be an improvement to make espionage something that requires investments and would make loss of a spy significant. Another one that he is suggesting is to change tech stealing to work similarly to science flow from trade routes. This would work so that you can get a per-turn tech bonus when researching a technology with the sieve where you have your spy nose. The bonus would be something like 5% of the tech cost. I think you'd have to tweak that heavily. This would be an improvement because it would make the random dice rolls less significant and remove the annoying dead times where you were spy active in a city and you researched the only tech that they knew. One other suggestion, change counter-espionage to work on a per-turn basis to accommodate the change in the tech stealing. Basically, each turn you would have a chance of catching an enemy spy, modified by the presence of a constabulary.
One of those words for sale again.
Well, he capitalized it and just threw it, yeah, well, the grammar is killing me here. And police station. These buildings face a major problem because they're completely useless in all but your top 1 to 3 cities, is what he's saying. And even in those cities, they are only borderline useful.
I think we should just give spies the treatment that we gave air units the treatment, which are promotions. Okay, yes, they do gain experience, but actual promotions that you get to choose from.
So we could specialize, like, with counter-espionage and stealing tech or diplomacy stuff?
Yeah, and so that would also extend to diplomats that were introduced in Brave New World, exactly. So then at least you could have some greater control over what it is that you're getting or likely to receive. So not only does it seem less random, but it also seems like it's a bit more of an involved process. Be a bit more active rather than passive.
I feel like these suggestions are a mixed bag. Like, I like the idea of having to make some sort of active investment into spies beyond just policy choices and everything, but like actual investment through cities to build them and to counter them being ramped up. That doesn't bother me. Now, balancing, it's another issue, but okay, the first point doesn't bother me. Second point makes them a little bit more similar to how they function in Civ 4, and I'm not sure I like that, especially with the whole percentage tech cost thing. I don't know, like, spies tend to be a catch-up mechanic, right? So
I do hate those dead times where you're just sitting for 20 to 30 turns and then you get absolutely nothing when you research the last tech that SIF has, despite the 20 to 30 turns you spent having that spy there when it could have been doing something else.
Maybe just some bonus research points?
It's not like that's the only thing you can try and do with the spy, though, right?
Well, I think what he's referring to is that you're only like one or two ticks ahead of somebody, and in the 30 turns it takes your spy to espionage, steal something, you've researched the two ticks, and then you have nothing, and you've wasted 30 turns with that spy. So something is returned, even if you got like half the value of a tech or a third or something.
Maybe if you can't steal a tech, you can steal something else like money or, you know, or sabotage buildings or sabotage production.
Well, okay, but that's a separate mechanic. We're referring directly to tech stealing here. But, like, if you know you're going to be able to steal something, and especially if you can only steal one thing, there's only a few bottlenecks, really, on the tech tree where you would be forced to research the thing you're attempting to steal. And let's be honest here, you can plan around stuff like that. I know that I probably wouldn't in any given game because I don't have the patience to plan out micro so far in advance, but... you know, your very elite players will plan that kind of stuff, so they'll know where the AI is going with this and whether or not they can steal this stuff. And if you put in the effort, you can do that. So what is the major benefit to basically stacking espionage on top of research on a tech you're currently researching? To me, that makes the mechanic less different from alternatives and more similar. You just get a research bonus. You know, all of a sudden it's like having a library or whatever.
Seeing as how the game rates whether or not you are ahead in technology based on the number of technologies you have as opposed to, you know, your actual beaker output, when he talks about, you know, like change tech stealing to work similar to science flow from trade routes, seeing as how you can already get science from, you know, other major civilizations through trade routes itself, maybe what it could be is if a civilization has technology X, and you then choose to research technology X, then you would get a beaker discount in researching that technology. Or just based on the percentage of the number of beakers that you're currently as an output. So then that way it's not being too much like a library, for example, not being so cumulative on top of another trade route at the same time. We also need to keep in the back of our minds that this is primarily a single-player game, and if we're going to introduce a mechanic, admittedly, what's the likelihood that the AI is going to be able to take advantage of this too? So I do make this recommendation in mind, thinking I don't know what would be involved in terms of the programming to get the AI to recognize that, which I guess could essentially be, how do I know if I'm getting that discount, Dan? Well, if you go to choose a particular technology, then just even a dialogue box to say the beaker cost would be in general, but then as like a hover over or something like that, some kind of prominent prompt on the screen to say, well, this is going to cost you like 5% less beakers because this civilization already has that technology, then you can actually make use of that purposely as opposed to incidentally. So in other words, you know you actually got that benefit because you were told up front, and then you could decide whether or not you wanted to follow through with that choice besides.
I don't know. It feels like unless you really bump this up from more than 5% of the tech cost, this would be a significant nerf, especially with all the bonuses you can stack on your spies to steal technologies, potentially, going down a different research path. Majin touched on that quite a bit in episode 182, and I feel like this particular kind of change could interfere with that, and then, you know, that has big implications on balance. It's not something you could do lightly. I mean, I guess you could change it like that, but what does it really add from changing it like that? I mean, yeah, you miss the dead times, but really, you shouldn't have a case where you're getting nothing from your spy if you're planning anyway. And it's the same thing with the other units in the game too, right? And if you build a unit, then don't use it for anything at all ever, then it's a dead unit, and your investment into that unit was dead time.
Yeah, which is why I'm saying, if you're going to invest that unit, if that unit's focus is going to be, okay, apply that discount to getting technology X because that civilization already has technology X, then you know you haven't sat around for 20, 30 turns. Oh, I'm going to be able to hopefully steal a technology. I could find out afterwards that, oh, hey, yeah, we can't actually steal any technology because we've already eclipsed them in research. And then you have wasted it. Whereas...
Yes, but you avoid that through planning. And not only that, when you change it to doing researching a technology that somebody else has, your own ability to pick your research while using spies becomes limited to what the AI has picked or has researched already, whereas currently that's not the case. That alone, in my opinion, is a significant nerf to the mechanic. simply because whereas before you could perhaps get one prerequisite tech for an important military unit while researching another yourself, now you would be forced to follow the AI's tech path or then lose out on the bonus of your spy completely. Whereas currently, if you plan for it, you don't really have dead time in most games. I mean, it would take something extremely unforeseen to turn your spy completely useless in this regard, because you have a general idea of what the AI is doing. I don't know that I like change number two here.
I thought usually you would get espionage information if there wasn't a tech to spiel, like they would say, oh, they're plotting against you or they're building a world wonder or something like that.
Well, yeah, but his point was...
I know, the time thing, but I guess I just haven't run across that because usually I'm playing on the lower difficulties or I'm playing multiplayer with you guys, so usually... When I'm playing multiplayer with you guys, I usually get espionage information if I don't get a tech. I can't pick it, so maybe if we could pick it and look to see if there was a tech and actually not research that tech and then make sure that spy was going to steal that said tech, then maybe that would avoid those dead times then.
Well, what you do know is some of the AI's tech, right?
Yeah.
And you can figure that out.
But you can't know exactly how far they are on the tech tree or if there's only two possible things that you haven't researched that they haven't.
Yeah. Well, there's some risk to the mechanic. Once you start knowing what the AI tends to do, that risk becomes a bit reduced, though.
You've got limited numbers of spies. You're going to get a spy when you, get to a next era.
Yeah.
You could also say that to avoid that kind of being like, oh, let's have like a cumulative effect. Like if I know, this civilization has technology X and I want that, if I place my spy in the capital and then I place it in their second city and their third city, then I can get like an even bigger discount or something like that, because then each spy would be giving you a discount on that technology in the civ. No, I think it should be, it must be and only be in the capital, for example, to avoid that from somebody saying, I can see how I could abuse this. And this would just be combined with the benefits that you're getting already. Because, yes, there are times where it is very purposeful, and you know that you're going to be able to get some technology. You know that you're going to be able to, at any time, look inside their city. You're going to get intelligence in X number of turns, even if you're not going to be able to steal the technology. So it's just to add to something that we already have, but at the same time, not make it too strong that it feels like you're stepping on the toes of, other things that you can do in the game.
Yeah, I think maybe being able to look in and see if they have a tech to steal, that way you can plan better to avoid those dead times. So, because I know in the previous versions when you went in there and you select steal tech and you'd have a selection of techs to try to steal, say, okay, try to steal this tech, and then you have to wait 13 turns or something just to see if he was successful in stealing that tech. That way you don't have to research it the hard way and then end up with dead time.
To be clear, though, I would not be in favor of, hey, let's like have what we had in Civilization 4 and let's poison the water supply. Let's spread discontent. No.
No,
don't do that.
You guys don't know the extent of the potential of spy abuse in Civ 4.
As some people could say, okay, well, folks, it didn't work very well in Civ 4, but maybe it would work better in Civ 5 because it's a different game. No.
yeah, just destroy their national wonders. That'll be popular.
I do miss buying cities outright in Civ 2. That was fun.
Well, that was cool, but not very balanced, but cool.
I want to put this in a scenario, go for it, but in the base game, no. Oh, I think I actually have a segue. Speaking of an issue, the next topic, I got an issue with what this person has to say. He argues that a shrine is greater than a monument. I think building a shrine is way more important than building a monument. And I put that emphasis on there because way is in all caps. A shrine gets you a pantheon which can significantly boost the value of tiles in your main cities or other benefits. Also gives you a shot at getting a good religion. Add on some of the beliefs you may get and the shrine is a future source of food or happiness. A monument just gives you culture, but not decisive. A shrine can give you a real edge. Generally, when I research pottery, I interrupt whatever I was building to rush the shrine. Getting it a few turns earlier may make the difference of a pantheon now with good choices or one way late where the best choices are already gone. Sometimes I start the monument, then interrupt the build to get the shrine out, then complete the monument. He says this in a follow-up post. The culture bonuses of a pantheon or religion will usually give you more social policies than the monument. Okay, the part that I agree with is that when you're researching pottery, interrupting whatever you're building to rush the shrine, say, and I'll add, like, going on production focus, can get you a pantheon a little sooner, which may give you a religion and may give you the ability to, when adopting the religion, choose the beliefs that you want. That's a lot of maze. But a monument, I admit that I typically tend to go tradition and then to go legalism. So I often do not construct a monument. Often, unless for some reason I find, you know, culture from a ruin, my shrine will be constructed before my monument by a few turns, because one of, if not my first technology research is pottery, and then yes, whatever it is that I'm constructing, I will switch over and go on production focus, because that can knock you down, say, on quick speed from even like 5 or 6 turns down to 4, and that can make a difference. But a shrine is not greater than a monument in terms of what it can give you, and it's definitely, to me, not an either-or, and I think it's actually even difficult to say that monument is greater than a shrine, because to me you're not really comparing like things. First of all, it's not like you're comparing two different culture buildings that you could build, either one or the other. But if you are just going to have one or the other, a monument is the better investment, because you know that from that point and throughout the rest of the game, it is going to be generating culture for you. So worry about, oh, I just quote-unquote got a pantheon out of it, but I didn't get a religion because they were all taken, and now I'm getting all this faith generation from shrines, and what am I going to be able to do with it that's meaningful, whether a religion, you know, spreads to me or not? Well, a monument is to me a no-brainer. If you're not going tradition and then legalism, I know a shrine is important, but if you go a monument first, it's not going to take you that much longer afterwards to get a shrine. Plus the fact you can start building the monument before you're ever able to build a shrine, because you need pottery. So by the time you might finish that monument, you can go ahead and build the shrine anyway, and then you've got both.
Yeah, because usually it's about 6 or 7 turns to build the monument, because that we play on quick speed for the multiplayer games, and it's about that long to research pottery. And so especially for your capital, you started on the culture early, and you get the shrine as soon as you possibly can.
He seems to go right for the henge and plays on immortal, and usually gets it, apparently.
I love that also, that a monument just gives you culture. No, there's this thing called tiles that you can acquire and then start working that you don't have to buy.
Shiny.
Now, someone does say, Matthew, period, and that's actually his username. There's a period at the end. He says, it depends on the difficulty level for me. On higher levels, I find it more trouble than it is worth to try and establish a religion. Thus, the shrine is largely useless. Now, I've got a caveat that there, because just because you do not necessarily establish religion does not mean that a pantheon that you could get from the shrine would be useless. Because until such a time as you found a religion, if you settle a new city and you have that pantheon is going to follow you to your city. And then if you can't get a religion, it would be nice to, at least until such a time as religion spreads to you, and if you decide to keep it, that you are actually getting some kind of benefit based on your geography, or just like a more general belief that, say, that gives you, you know, happiness, for example, across your entire empire.
Yeah, I think it's more important to build up your culture going for tradition or liberty.
A liberty gives you a +1 culture in each one of your cities.
Find that you'll find a religious city or a faith out of a ruins, or even find a natural wonder that'll have faith on it as well. So there's a lot of other things that'll get you to that pantheon. Because shrines, it's like you said, there's a lot of maze. There's too many ifs with the shrine, and there's no ifs at all with the monument. It will give you culture, and it will open your tiles, and it will help you open your social policies. And so, yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, the monument is pretty good, but if you build your scout first, because if you're not playing on an islands map, then it's going to take you like 20 or so turns to get to your first social policy if you're playing on standard speed. Legalism is not going to be how you get your monument.
Not to the same extent as a religion, but if you don't end up with a pantheon, if it's that late and you realize, oh, I can't get a, you know, a pantheon anymore, then okay, maybe then you don't need to worry about the shrine. But tell me one instance where you would not want to construct a monument. That's kind of what it comes down to. Is that situational, constructing a monument? maybe when you construct the monument later in the game, maybe that might vary, or whether you buy it later on or something like that. But
it was funny how I was just thinking today how, like, in Civ 4, it would be situational with me if I was going to make a monument or not. But now in Civ 5, it's like, I always build a monument. It's like, you have to. It's a requirement to get all your cities to expand their tiles.
Well, unless you like unnecessary pain.
I think I see a nice segue there. Speaking of religion,
nice.
By Marshall M. I actually got a pronounceable name. Maybe Phil should have done this one.
No. See, we have to be nice to our first-time guests because, you know, we'd like them to come back, possibly.
Besides, then I'd miss out on my calling card of completely butchering names, among other calling cards of fail. I mean, Phil.
Well, that's true. How else would we otherwise know that Phil's on the call? No, just kidding.
Probably the trolling.
Well, isn't that inclusive, though? That's part of your trolling ability, is to butcher names and
words. Oh, yeah, but it's just a tiny part.
A little editorialization. I wonder if there's actually some trolling in this post. I wonder how serious this person is. They are serious, but I'm sorry. I'm being unnecessarily mean. We'll get to that, Ikat.
So, over the course of patches in now Brave New World, I think some beliefs really need changes in box, otherwise they're totally useless, many are at least situational. So for Pantheon beliefs, he thinks that ancestor worship, Pantheon belief that gives you the plus one culture for a shrine. There's no reason that you would take this over, say, oral tradition or god of the open sky in a four-city empire. We need just a total of four plantations or four pastures to trump ancestor worship. I think this kind of assumes that you're playing a tall empire. And while those I sometimes find tend to be better in Brave New World, still, there is a very limited amount of resources on the map, so there will be eventually payoff.
Yeah, I agree that ancestor worship is weak, though I do think absolute statements are absolutely problematic. So when he says there's no reason why anyone would take this over, well, when we're talking about a pantheon, you want something that's going to give you benefit in the short, if not the shorter term, to better position yourself to do whatever it is that you want to do. Hopefully that means going for a religion, but even not necessarily. So if you, for instance, had no tiles for plantations, I know he says that they're very easy to find, or maybe if you can only find bananas. No, I could actually see situations where you might take ancestor worship over oral tradition or even god of the open sky. Like, what if you have no tiles for pastures, or you're prioritizing other tiles? That is very situational, like he's talking about, but it's not terrible. It's not that I think that the pantheon is terrible. I just think that there are stronger ones. But let's not say there's no reason why anyone would take it.
God of war, four tiles is pretty limiting, and the faith it generates is pretty small. So taking the pantheon almost means no pantheon at all. You have a course by bar camp to find, and maybe, and if you're a deity and you've got a term 30 gal, then from Shaka, then maybe this might be useful. He does point out that it is situationally useful, and at least he didn't make a absolute statement that it's never useful. It isn't something I'd normally take, but there are situations like you described in the post here that I think it is quite helpful.
Yeah, I think that this is situational too, but to me it's even more situational than ancestor worship, because you probably have shrines, okay? And you're going to getting plus one culture per turn for those shrines. But situational, killing a unit within four tiles, kind of given also what else is available, I can honestly say I've never chosen this one. Although taking this pantheon, okay, yes, almost means taking no pantheon at all. Maybe that's a little harshly worded, but okay, I guess I won't disagree with that. And for our listeners wondering, what does he mean by closely barb camp that you can farm? How do you farm barbarians? So that's where you're bombarding barbarians out of a camp or even immediately beside a camp with ranged units, or at the least only using melee units not on the camp. So you clear the barbarian, but you keep the camp, and then more barbarians are spawned, and then you take them out, hence farming or cultivating barbarians. Where else in the world can you talk about culting barbarians except in Civilization? Accurately. It's a great sentence. Anyway.
So then there's goddess of love. Yes, plus one, plus happiness is nice, but really needing fit six followers doesn't kick in until pretty late. What you really need in the early part of the game, where pantheons matter most, is faith, culture, food. One happiness is not going to do it. And on difficulty levels, when happiness is useful, kicking this pantheon means you're not very likely to get a religion, which means when you really need it, the pantheon's going to get wiped by someone else's religion.
I'll let somebody else talk about this first, but I will say for anyone that's familiar with NCIS, I'm sorry, who's this person again? Marshall N. You need a gib slap for that statement. First off, let me just say, okay, I know I said I was going to let somebody else talk, but I got to say one other thing, because this is how, it's not six followers, it's six population in a city. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you have that many followers in the city. Size six population, there's a difference.
Minute hits by six, boom, happy.
Yeah, size six doesn't take, it shouldn't take you long to get to if you have food around you.
Basically what this is doing is it's paying for the growth of the six population. So basically, you could ICS, and as long as you could cover the first five population, it's just basically a free extra point of population.
It's actually decent. It's not the best ever, but it's not as bad as he seems to think.
People don't really viably ICS anymore, though. Like, from what I'm seeing, it's... I mean, you can do it, but it usually doesn't beat your alternatives.
It's been nerfed, finally.
So, religious settlements, why not just open tradition instead and take something like fertility rights? Religious settlements isn't the best. I do kind of agree with them on this one.
Yeah, I do too. And besides what Marshall says, if you really want more border growth, why don't you take the tradition opener, which greatly increases your rate of border expansion? Because, hey, time back to the earlier topic, so then you can go legalism and get a free monument, i.e. no maintenance cost, and if you haven't built them yet, boom, instant monument in your first four cities, and choose another pantheon instead. I mean, it would be fun to use this to troll as the Shoshone, because you could take that, and then you could take this pantheon, and plus tradition, but that's like, that's like one in how many games? This pantheon, it, to me, is next to worthless.
Moving on to founder base, we have church property, which city spending is hard now, and AI works much harder at spending religion, plus you go up with no lot, and you can realistically maybe a max of 10 to 15 cities following your religion. Hive, in my experience, is almost always stronger, because you don't need to be the majority to get the bonus, and it scales nicely throughout the game. So late game, your capital alone can give you 8 to 10. Church property is one of those beliefs that I kind of agree with him on this one, actually.
I don't.
Fight! No, I mean, argue.
You can get it in more than 10 to 15 cities max. I don't know what he's doing, but he's doing it wrong. And, you know, I've played multiplayer games where I've seen, you know, in our multiplayer games, I can see we've had more cities than 10 to 15. And in my games, I always have more cities than 10 to 15 following the religion. So he's doing it wrong. That's all I can say.
I think taking a spoon depends on how well you think you can spread your religion. Like, if you
put
that folklore at the beginning and you got really a high faith generation, then I can see a good reason to do this because you'll be able to spread your religion far and wide. However, for those of us who can't handle huge maps, the only exception I think is if you're playing as Byzantium and you take itinerant creatures as a bonus belief and you enhance it with religious texts. And it's easy to get your religion every city on the map you have at Mountain.
I agree when he says here that it might have, you know, the church property might have been good in pre-Brave New World days. I think that church property is hurt a little more post-Brave New World than even Goddess of Love is. But if tithe is taken, and tithe gives you plus one gold for every four followers, then church property can be a decent alternative, kind of if, like Kat was saying, that you're going to not only make a concerted effort to try to spread your religion, but honestly, look at those immediately around you. Have they founded a religion? Do they already have a religion in place? If the answer is no to both of those questions, or even one, then it's going to be some effort to spread, but unless you think you're going to be getting into like a religious spread war and then spending all this effort to build or, you know, buy missionaries, then can be a decent alternative. But this is more situational than tithe, whereas tithe, you know, with plus one gold for every four followers, whether you're going tall or wide, it is more powerful. But I think church property can be a decent alternative to tithe. I don't think it's as bad as he tries to paint its picture to be.
So the next one is papal primacy, so the opportunity cost of taking this over tithe, ceremonial burial, or peace letting is pretty high, and a consulate, it's plus pledge to protect, you don't really need the extra 15, if they have consulates slightly, as they should, then this could be a useful belief. I rarely, if ever, take this over other really good founder beliefs, like gold in the early game is much rarer than it used to be. The early gold beliefs really help. Ceremonial burial and peace loving are both obviously quite useful if you want to expand quickly. So
Yeah, because they're giving you plus one global happiness either for every two cities following the religion and ceremonial burial. Okay, not as good as in Gods and Kings, but still very good. Or peace-loving, which is the plus one global happiness for every eight followers of this religion in non-enemy foreign cities. So, like, I would take tithe, then ceremonial burial, then peace-loving. But papal primacy, yeah, I agree. It is just, there is just nothing really positive to say about it. Most of the time.
And with consulates pledged to protect, you don't even need it to get up REM stats unless you don't want to pledge to protect all of them because you've got some AI that you don't want to get angry because they're bullying all the city states.
Let's try to help out papal primacy a little bit. Are you playing Greece? Are you Austria?
Or Venice?
Or Venice. Oh, okay, maybe those three, maybe you can make it work. And even then, it's a maybe. So that's a pretty narrow focus.
Next belief is pilgrimage, which, again, we need to really work with it to get the benefit out of this. The extra faith you get won't compensate for the faith you spent spreading.
Yeah, I only agree somewhat with this. I only agree somewhat.
I agree in some situations and disagree in other situations. Like, if you've already got pretty good faith generation, or you've got really bad faith generation, pilgrimage can be all you need to get the faith you need to really spread that religion and take it yet, like, diplomatic opinion bonuses with a lot of AI neighbors, which can be really helpful because they're not going to value as much as they like you, at least in most cases.
Oh, yeah, true, true. If most of their cities are following your religion, then boom, positive diplomatic modifier.
At least before the industrial era.
Well, yeah, that's true, but cultivating those friendships earlier in the game makes it easier to maintain and expand on them in the later game. So, to get to the later game, unless you're doing an advanced start, position yourself well in the early game, I think if you are able to combine pilgrimage and say you can also construct mosques, which give you plus three faith for each mosque, or even pagodas, plus two, as a follower belief, this can be quite powerful. Or, like church property, there are situations where if you can spread your religion quickly, you can, you know, emphasize that influence through external trade, missionaries, great prophets, religious buildings, or wonders, then you can get a decent return on investment if it can happen early and quickly enough. So, if you can accelerate that spreading of your religion, you can turn it to your benefit. It would be worth choosing this over something else.
Pilgrimage, with all that extra faith, if you take, like, tithe plus world, plus pilgrimage as Byzantium, that could be a pretty good combo.
Yeah, seeing as how when founding a religion, Byzantium gets to choose another belief, I think it's unavoidable to talk about Byzantium when you're talking about religious beliefs. Or if we did, we're not doing our job on this show.
All right, so moving on to the next one, World Church. Basically a terrible version of peace-loving. Yes, it's 10 enemy sibs too, but one culture is a lot less than one happiness.
I agree mostly with that. I mean, if there are one or more taller empires near you and you can place yourself as the dominant religion there, you get plus one culture for every five followers of this religion and other civilizations, that can give you a nice boost to your culture output.
That's another thing you have to really work for.
You have to put at least some effort into it.
I do agree with this. Moving on to the one follower belief he doesn't like, liturgical drama. Do people even build amphitheaters anymore other than the minimum number you need to house writers? Plus
yes.
One.
Yes. If you want opera house and museum, you better.
You want more culture later if you're playing a culture game? Yes, you do.
Yes, so apparently we all disagree with that statement. Since the plus one faith is a joke, there are a lot of good follower beliefs to choose from. The second part I do kind of agree with. Plus one faith is not going to make a big difference in the long run. However, the first statement here, very wrong. The enhancer belief, I found there is no truly bad enhancer, each can have its own uses. My only gripe is that the science and gold values are not scaled for epic marathon games. Faith costs for missionaries / prophets are, so the faith if to gold science conversion ratio is horrible, making them bad choices for those game lengths. Missionary zeal is probably the weakest, but the difference is not really that noticeable in my experience.
Kind of like when we were talking about ideologies last episode, we're like, you know, level 2, level 3. Well, there really is no bad ideology at that level. It's a good thing that there's truly no bad enhancer because you got the pantheon, you got the religion. Now you've got enough faith in order to get an enhancer. Yeah, I agree.
And the one Reformation belief he thinks is bad is religious fervor. Between the person and units, it's hard to justify buying units when the faith cost is so high, and you can buy an engineer or scientist or a musician or whatever. You have to be really desperate to use it to buy units, maybe if the cost comes down.
I have to disagree. I found it useful to buy those late units because the great people get more and more expensive, and military units tend to stay around the same. And
yeah, it's like he thinks those are expensive. Have you seen how expensive the great people get after a certain point?
Very expensive.
Like 6,000 faith. What the crap?
Yep.
I need to have like maybe 100 faith generation to realistically see myself buying that one. 4,000 faith plus the 5,000 or so that you've already spent buying great people, so that's 9,000 faith.
Yeah, so what Mackie, Scott, and Ecat are saying is when it comes to buying great people with faith, inflation is a bit.
Yes. Very much.
Diminishing returns.
I realize that's working as intended, but it's just like, no, I need this one last person at this time, but it's going to cost me so much. Ah!
Seems like a Phil post, so yeah, this is a good topic. Phil.
One of the reasons why I suggested Phil introduce it, actually.
Yeah, I saw the list of things that each of us are introducing, and I definitely raised an eyebrow that this got assigned to me, but I have no complaints about it. Okay, thread is titled 10 Fixes Needed for the Fall Patch by Jada Paik. This thread gets right into it. He basically says, these are the 10 fixes needed for the fall patch, period. Let's see if we agree. Starting with number 10, Piety Opener should provide culture. And his argument is that Tradition, Liberty, and Honor Openers all provide culture. Piety Opener should also provide culture, making it a more useful tree to open early in the game.
It sort of does.
Yeah, I gotta say I strongly disagree with this.
If you're doing Piety the right way, you should be getting culture. A balanced thing for you to choose between fast faith or slower culture with Piety.
I don't know. At least choosing Piety first is questionable.
Yeah, most people take one of those three as their opener, and then go over to Piety, like for their third or something, you know.
Yeah,
that's what I would do.
I like taking the Piety opener when I get, like, a Desert Star, and I really want one of those pantheons that provide extra faith, and I don't want one of the AIs to sneak it out.
Oh, yeah, you want to get the Desert Folklore out if they pick.
Now, as far as I'm concerned, it is a valid point that any of your initial choices for openers in the game should probably be viable at least some of the time. I'm just not sure that this is the way that you would make Piety viable against, say, Tradition. Honor's also kind of behind. Despite what I say and what I prefer, Honor's not exactly the strongest opener, typically.
No, definitely not. Yes, okay, Honor will give you culture when you kill barbarians. That requires the player to be more proactive through combat, whereas Tradition and Liberty are designed to better complement a tall and wide empire respectively, but not exclusively. And before Brave New World, we had this identity crisis, and we talked about this on the show, Piety. Is it trying to go culture? Is it trying to go faith? It tried to do both and failed at both. I could see someone making the argument, how come aesthetics, we can only get that later? How come we can't choose to go aesthetics instead of Piety, you know, at the same time? And that could be a whole separate conversation. But Piety opener providing culture, no. Like Mackie was saying, if you're doing things right, you're going to be getting culture otherwise. So culture through faith, really, so to speak.
One way or the other.
So we can change number 10 to Piety should be tweaked, but not necessarily provide culture.
Little tweaking.
Number 9, improve Denmark. Denmark trees, useless, stupid, and a complete waste. It's replaced with a Viking longboat melee naval unit that has a bonus versus city and a bonus with amount of gold generated from attacking a city. Coastal cities should be terrified of Viking invasions.
I approve.
A pirate ship?
Viking pirates,
Yeah, Viking pirates.
Particularly popular at the moment anyway from a strength standpoint.
I do like the sound of that Viking longboat. It would be much more historically accurate, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether the ski infantry is useless, stupid, and a complete waste is probably up for debate.
Yeah.
I disagree, actually, with him saying improving Denmark. I agree that the Norwegian ski infantry is very situational most of the time. For those listening, not knowing or remembering, it specializes in operating in snow, tundra, and hills, unless there's forest or jungle there, where it's double speed and it also gets a 25% combat boost, but it doesn't come until the industrial era because it replaces riflemen. I agree that this unit isn't strong. However, the Viking unique ability, embark units having plus one movement and pay just one movement point to move from sea to land, and melee units pay no movement costs to pillage, makes up for it. And besides, there are other civilizations that need more attention first. Japan!
Let's continue to number 8. City attack strength. When no melee units are garrisoned, cities should be easier to conquer if they have no defenders or have only ranged defenders. This will increase early warfare and buff the honor policy. I don't have any problem with that. I always despised how strong cities can get, so, you know, whatever.
And I do agree that there should be, the melee unit should have a purpose inside the city, because usually it just gets wiped out like that, like it wasn't even there.
Yeah, and I generally find garrisoning melee units in a city is quite useless because they won't be able to really attack any of the ranged units from behind. They'd only be able to attack things right next to the city, and it would still have to heal.
Yeah,
so.
Ranged unit in the city is a lot more useful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The only time you would do that is like when you have those, that nice little policy we all remember with the units being garrisoned raising your happiness. And you have some junk units left over or something, but I don't know. It's kind of niche.
Like you didn't get iron and you were unable to upgrade your early warrior.
Yeah, maybe.
I guess I'm going to stand alone on the panel. I disagree. I disagree with this suggestion.
So say I disagree, sire.
I disagree, sire.
Look, base city defenses are intended to simulate, like, not just any defensive buildings, if and when they're present, but also, like, the citizenry defense itself in the city. But, moreover, remember that the presence of a unit in a city, whether it's melee ranged or whatever, increases the base strength. So, if and when they depart, the city strength is lowered. So, it's already represented in the game, as far as I'm concerned.
So, basically, he's just advocating that you nerf the base city strength, then. And there, too, I don't have a problem with that. I think that actually surviving should require investment in military, and increasing that slightly is not necessarily a bad thing. Especially early war now is been quite nerfed down anyway.
Which is why I disagree with this, but not strongly disagree with what he's saying.
After all, the citizenry were not particularly effective defenders for much of history, with some exceptions, but generally speaking, not so much.
Maybe having units in the city should provide a bigger bonus than just one or two extra combat strength for the city.
I don't know. It's not that hard to stuff something in the city. But if you're meaning, like, the city is weaker without units, then it gets buffed up to, like, current values if a unit's in it, I guess I could see that. Man, hitting on the flanks would be nasty. That'd really up the surprise attack. I guess we're down to number 7 now. Add new luxuries and new bonuses. Well, okay. So it should be encouraged to settle far-flung colonies for new luxuries and bonuses, where tea, coffee, apples, really apples, mangoes, rice, what? More luxury bonuses will buff wide players.
Luxury things and apples.
Rice?
Well, apple is for food. I
corn?
Guess.
Yeah, I guess as a bonus, sure. Like you get, okay, apples.
Yeah,
rice.
Apples in the forest,
okay,
maybe.
That's fine. That's fine. Get a little extra food from it. It looks different. It's cool.
Yeah, but definitely, where's my coffee? But no, seriously, with the coffee and the tea historically were big trade things, so why aren't they in there? And it wouldn't hurt to bring back rice and corn for extra food, especially on, oh, I don't know, planes?
Yeah.
Ugh. Planes could really use a box.
We already encouraged in Civ 5 to settle to get luxuries and bonuses. I can see the arguments for like adding tea and coffee, for example, but just like adding new luxuries and new bonuses, period. I mean, assuming with the luxuries, he's talking about more happiness. Well, let's see. How else can you get happiness? Buildings, wonders, social policies, religious beliefs, ideological tenets. So I don't strongly disagree, but I do disagree.
He does specifically say to buff wide players, as in looking for more cities. Number 6, make AI calculate one-to-one luxury trades for We Love the King Day bonuses. I have pearl, but I need silk for We Love the King Day. Alex has silk, but needs pearl for We Love the King Day. Even trade is clearly reasonable if we are friendly with each other.
Finally, I agree with them.
This is not just beneficial to the player,
but also to the AI. Like, the AI should not spite itself for this.
I really hate, like, they have multiples of an item, and I have multiples of an item, and I want to do this one-to-one trade, and they won't do it unless I give everything for this one freaking luxury. It's like, what did I do to you? What did I do to you to make you so angry at me?
Maybe it's one of those cases of them being fake friendly or something. Because they're about to attack your face.
Well, okay, so then there'd be situations, but it's just like consistently every single time, even when they don't attack my face afterwards, they're still like, nope.
One-to-one luxurator traits are pretty reasonable. I don't know how you wouldn't do them normally.
Yeah.
It basically puts the two civs making the trade ahead of every other civ at the fundamental level.
The AI is actually a lot better with one-to-one trades already, so it's kind of sad that this isn't here, as opposed to, you know, in a single trade dealing with multiple items. Like, as an aside to this, anyone notice, I would like to trade, say, gems and cotton for fur and citrus. The AI is like, no. But then if you do the one at a time, how about the fur for the gems? And then you do the other trade afterwards, then they'll agree to that. If you do it as separate deals on the same turn, what the heck? Do you have difficulty multitasking, AI? That's sad. I'd actually like to see that fixed first.
These commodities have some sort of value attached to them that should not be altered by combining them.
Yeah, like AI, you do not get more points in the game because you have two smaller trade deals with me instead of one larger one. What is your problem?
Number 5, Lake Victoria is not a mountain.
I struggled with that.
Yeah, this is probably the best one on the list.
I don't know about this one. I might have to disagree.
Is it on a mountain, perhaps?
Let's actually have Lake Victoria, I don't know, be a lake.
Oh, man. As much problem placement as we have with it trying to put down Krakatoa, can you imagine it trying to find a lake to put Lake Victoria in?
You know what they should do? Make Lake Victoria something else each time that isn't a lake. Just constantly rotate through, like, complete nonsense to represent.
It's a hill. Lake.
It's a river. Yeah. It's a marsh.
It's a ruin.
Just put a GDR there and call it Lake Victoria. Ending unit turn on top of enemy caravan should auto-plunder. I question the grammar of the statement. Anyway, I shouldn't be required to station a unit one hex in front of a caravan or land on a caravan with an extra movement point to plunder the trade route. If the trade route auto-plunders when the caravan runs into a unit, it should auto-plunder if I end the unit's turn on top of an enemy caravan.
Agree.
Okay, yeah, the AI gets this. Why don't we?
Yep.
I call shenanigans.
Number 3. Archaeological digs shouldn't destroy great person improvements.
Doesn't happen very often, but yeah, that's kind of what.
Yep.
I think the better question is, what's the edit do with those at?
Then I would say that...
Mild enhancement to your great person thing?
Yeah, that works. I mean, yeah, archaeological digs destroying great person improvements, that's kind of a very minor, why the hell are you still playing this game? Play this long in this individual game, you should have started another one.
Like, give you only half of what you get to put a landmark there.
There you go.
Sure.
I can agree with that.
OMG, Mackie's applying logic.
All right.
No, it weighs.
Number 2, add more World Congress abilities. We need more interesting choices with the World Congress. How about forcing the liberation of a city-state or dead Civ City? How about banning a certain unit type? How about buffs to trade routes, units, unit abilities, or buildings? Banning a certain unit type, there are no workers! No workers at all! Get off the world! Now we start pillaging!
No. Forcing the liberation of a city-state or a dead Civ City? No! This is a game!
Troll!
That's awful.
Should be more World Congress abilities, I think, but not specifically the ones he mentions here.
Yes, that.
Well, I like the idea of banning workers, but aside from that.
In Phil's world, it's just a warm nuke. Who do we need workers for? There's nothing to improve.
And then finally, improve diplomats and improve spies. Diplomats should boost trade offers beyond World Congress voting. You should be able to trade tech. And trade resource bonus. How to use diplomats to buy World Congress votes. That location should be visible to the player. Spies should be able to assassinate diplomats, conduct attacks on cities, and give bonuses to military units attacking the city.
We already discussed improving spies.
He has some different takes on how one would improve spies. I don't know about actually giving the spies the ability to attack a city. That sounds like a military unit to me.
Yeah.
But having them alter the defensive capabilities of a city in some way is plausible.
Yeah, this is not Civilization Revolution.
Spies are your only military unit. Just take all the empire. those.
In Civilization Revolution, if you moved a spy into a city, you could have it destroy all defensive buildings.
Nice.
So, no.
I don't know if I'd advocate going that far. Just if you give them other things to do, it's not necessarily bad. It just depends what you give them.
How do the spies do this without a destroyed defensive building without being noticed?
I guess at the very least, if you do that, then your spy just dies in that process.
I like how in Civ 4 you incite city revolts and completely nullify all defensive bonuses for the time.
That was fair and balanced,
for sure.
Buying defensive agreements? Okay.
Yeah, okay. Trade resource bonuses. All right.
Okay, what does that even mean, though? Like, if you wanted 5 horses and I have 5 iron, and you have 5 iron and I have 5 horses, we exchange. Do we not just trade resource bonuses?
I don't know. Maybe you need, like, the presence of diplomats alters the willingness for this or something. It's not really clear.
Okay, diplomatic relations are more friendly, therefore they're more likely to go for that trade.
Oh, more likely to trade. Oh, okay. I'd be fine with that, then.
He also once said the AI to understand how to use diplomats to buy World Congress votes. I think that's reasonable. If it's a feature in the game, the AI should probably have some idea how to reuse it, ideally.
Competently.
Yeah.
This thread started by El Cavalaron. What Civ could learn from Settlers of Catan and Victory Points? And it says, okay, is it safe to say that the most people here have played the board game, also available on iPhone, Settlers of Catan? It's a game about colonizing a small hexagonal island and harvesting its resources. Sounds dull, but is actually the most amazing thing ever. It just made me think about something. I have always found early mid-game Civ to be absolutely engrossing, but I always played as a sandbox with no concrete goal in mind. I'm content to build and grow my empire in whatever fun ways I can, but always feel rushed by the end and its need to capitalize on one victory condition. Catan is a great game because all of the players need to have 10 victory points, which range from several different conditions. I have played games where player A appears to win by having 9 visible victory points on the board, only to have player B with only 6 visible points totally whoop at by unleashing strategies in his turn, giving him 4 points. Civ doesn't have this, but it should, in my honest opinion. A Civ should considered a winner for several reasons, and these reasons could appear as possibilities as the game goes. For instance, Civ can start with absolutely no victory condition in mind, but these victory conditions appear as the game develops, perhaps pulled from over 100 different conditions. Then the players must have accumulate victory points, allowing them to let the game tailor their victory condition. Some ideas, each worth 1 victory point, and randomly appear as condition progresses. Ideally, there would be 100 conditions, that's a lot, and these have expanded every time there's a new DLC. It would help to make the game more organic and less playing in a specific style from turn one. Thoughts?
I believe that, yes, Civ can learn from Settlers of Catan and victory points. However, having victory points in Civ, like we have in Settlers of Catan, I'm not so convinced.
What I think is that I think the idea of having a dynamic system like this, maybe if there was a mission system where you were given this mission that you could do and you got, like, some reward for completing it, like a bunch of gold or a bunch of faith or some bonus including these, but not necessarily directly victory points.
I like that a lot better. Rather than having it just be a generic victory point, you get something that's worth it, very good perhaps, depending on what you're accomplishing. That is a significant contributor to one of the victory conditions, ultimately, but you still have to reach those victory conditions. But this gives you some goals you can pursue before the end game that have real rewards.
Yeah, so long as all of these are very well-stated victory points and not, you know, just randomly popping up like in a certain Mario Party game.
Yeah, so we don't need Mario Party features in Civ.
Yeah, because I was just kind of noticing the way he was talking about it. It's like he could be way in the behind where someone else is in the lead and then you just suddenly jump up. And I think we want to avoid it being, like, completely random.
I will say that if you like Civilization, as a related aside, you will probably like Settlers of Catan.
Yeah.
Because it's like a microcosm of Civ where it gets right to the point of the game. The focusing on connecting resources and trading resources and trying to outmaneuver your fellow human players. There is no AI here. I think I just a couple of comments from the thread that I particularly enjoyed. One was, in a way, Civ is already a big longest road alarmist army competition, except instead of getting a point, you just win from Civ Mike. Or or the game already has victory points, just disable every victory condition except time. Or El Caballeron had said, another reason, you know, I bring all this up is because in real life, our ancestors weren't trying to get a domination victory or a science victory. And Drelix says, our ancestors weren't playing a game.
How do you know?
It's all a game. It's just a matter of the stakes.
Maybe we are all players in a game. We just didn't know that it's a game, and it's actually being controlled by much superior beings to ourselves. Who knows?
Yeah, like a 12-year-old super alien or something who's calling his peers derogatory terms while mishandling us.
Look up Star Trek, the original series, and find the episode with Trelane in it.
Oh, yeah, the one that people like to call Q before Q was there.
Calling today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Too late.
It's too late to save ourselves.
Too late, we've seen everything.
Too late, we've said everything.
That's never true.
Anyway, this has been episode 183. I'm still Makalua, and of course always with us is Dan.
I spy with my little eye something that is squared.
You?
Is this a mirror?
The me and team.
My empires are wide and expansive.
He always manages to make that sound not like it should. And our two guest co-hosts today, E-Cat.
I need to fix my audio issues.
Yeah, and turn off the ice cream machine in the background or something.
How much ice cream can you eat?
I don't even have an ice cream machine.
Oh, sorry, yogurt.
Whatever.
Frozen yogurt, quote unquote.
And Alpha Shard.
Hey, have a good day. I didn't have anything funny to say, but I still made you laugh. I'm pro.
Like Mackie said, we've said everything, so what was there?
What was left? What was left?
In closing, I say hello.
Oh, goodbye.
Let's see if I can pronounce the username properly, otherwise I'll join the club of Phil. Is Dio Ziong? Maybe the X, one or more of the X's is silent. I don't know. Double X. That's your new username. Please don't take offense.
You definitely just joined the me and team club.
Double X.
You really did. You
although
really
he
did.
Does find the end of his post, Double X. So.
Oh, there you go.
If you distort that, you might have been able to get a...
It's Zhao Zong.
Zhao Zong.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I was going to... Yes.
We'll see if that comes up as we go down the list, shall we? It is, after all, only 9.
It is.
Unless you're reading the thread, then you know the answer to that. All right, so...
Oh, why would you... Wait. Why would you read the thread before listening to us talk about it on the show? I mean, why spoil it for yourself?
Oh,
my word.
Fortunate reality that said thread was posted on September 13th, 2013. And this show is probably only going to be released to an online audience well over a week after that, so, you know.
October? Mackie, what are you talking about? There's more than a week left in September when we record this. Come on, now. Hey, now.
And if we're not supposed to read the thread, then why do you post links to the thread in the chat for the live stream?
Exactly.
That's just for you to load the thread so you can read along with us, not skip ahead. I'm hung up on spies for some reason. Not the diplomats part of this argument. I don't know why.
It's like spies? Spies?
Diplomat equals spies, right? It's just a synonym.
A spy without a gun?
A spy that didn't bang me? ... Moving on.
This thread was started by El Calab...
18 Club. I'll for more.
I was about to say, Phil's the president, I'm the vice president, Scott can be the treasurer.
Okay. The thread is, what civ for, or no, I'm sorry, what civ confer?
CIV is civ for, guys.
Yeah.
Okay, so I do that again.
And I obviously have to sing, Mackie, because if Phil doesn't troll or mispronounce words on a call, how do we know it's Phil? If I don't sing, how do you know it's really me?
Because you're so polite and Canadian.
No, I'm not.
Right.
You said dance and polite.
Thank you for setting that up for me, Mackie. That was perfect. Record date September 21st, 2013. Civilization 4 and 5 sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.